Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Think about that line from the movie Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. Cliche, sure, but that's what's going on here in Dubai. And now that they're building it, they're making it easier to come. From American Public Media and live from Dubai, this is Marketplace.
Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. And by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com.
Direct from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you with us today as we continue our coverage of the Middle East at Work. It is Thursday, the 13th of March. I had some time to kill on my trip over here a couple of weeks ago. I was booked on an Emirates Airlines flight out of Kennedy Airport in New York. And I had heard the Emirates Lounge at JFK is pretty nice, so I figured I'd give it a shot, try to talk my way in, you know, even though I was riding all the way in the back of the plane.
I'm so sorry, sir, but this is an exclusive first and business class lounge. Welcome in first business and Skywards Gold passenger. At this time, I wouldn't be able to give you lounge access.
So back downstairs I went for 3 hours of sitting around waiting to get on a 12-and-a-half-hour flight.
Together with my colleagues here on the flight deck, I'd like to welcome you aboard. Emirates Flight 202 bound for Dubai.
Bound for Dubai, that's the key thing to remember about this company, because it wasn't really started as an airline so much as a means to an end. Dale Griffith is in charge of Emirates ground operations worldwide. He's been with them almost since the beginning.
The idea was not to, in actual fact, put together a commercial concern per se. It was, in actual fact, to help Dubai build for the future.
The formula was pretty simple.
Our mission is to be able to carry a passenger from anywhere on this planet via Dubai to any other place on this planet.
It's true. You pull up a route map on their website, you see you can't get anywhere from anywhere on Emirates unless you go through Dubai. For that to be attractive to passengers, it had to be affordable. So just like the city, the airline does everything in volume. It buys big airplanes. They've got 58 of those new double-decker Airbuses on order, twice as many as the next guy. And it flies those planes big distances. It's almost 7,000 miles between here and JFK in New York, a route that Emirates flies back and forth twice a day, with planes like mine that were packed solid in the back, 10 seats across, every one of them full. 20 years after it started flying, with two rented airplanes, those economies of scale have made Emirates one of the top 10 airlines in the world, measured by passengers carried and miles flown. But they've also made it a target.
Unfairness is in the eye of the beholder.
Richard Abulafi is an airline analyst with the Teal Group. There have been whispered complaints for years, never proved and consistently denied by the company, that the government of Dubai goes out of its way to make sure that Emirates is successful.
Unquestionably, any airline that's been created with government cash has an advantage over somebody who has to go out to the private sector. From an established airline perspective, they might not be at all happy because, of course, it's somebody else's tax dollars, and indeed oil money, that's making this competitor so strong.
Inside the company, they see it a little differently, no surprise. Again, Dale Griffith, he runs the ground side of Emirates.
Well, we know they think it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what is happening. So, yes, we are able to take some of the business that exists, but we are also a huge vehicle for the development of incremental business and full-service incremental business.
It's the old rising tide lifts all boats arguments that, yeah, Emirates takes business from other airlines, but it gets more people flying overall, which then helps those other airlines grow. As for full service, it's more than just a point of pride for Emirates. Luxury is a key part of their business model. I took a hangar tour with Ian Lachlan. He's the Emirates Senior VP for Maintenance. We walked through a couple of planes in various stages of repair, and then we checked out the new private suites in Emirates First Class.
Oh, my God.
So this is like basically cubicles in an airplane.
Yeah.
Except they're nicer than most office cubicles.
This is what's called Ultra Suite.
Yeah.
And I have a guy who goes around all day with a suitcase, to clean up ink marks or things that are left.
That's his job. He's the ultra suede guy.
As he goes around and he ensures that we don't have that particular problems on the mini suites. The leather seats are full recline. We have a significant number of different massages on board on each seat.
I did eventually get a tour of an Emirates lounge, too. Pretty nice, just as I expected. Afterward, I asked Dale Griffith how Emirates is going to know when it's big enough. He laughed a little bit, and he said, you know, that question's never crossed anybody's mind. It's kind of like the city of Dubai. If you build it, they will come. The unofficial truce that had been holding between the Israelis and the Palestinians has broken down. There were rocket attacks and air raids in the West Bank and Gaza overnight. So far, politics hasn't been able to bring peace to this part of the world. Marketplace's Sam Eaton went to the West Bank, where some Palestinians and Israelis are using economics as a roadmap.
The hills surrounding Jenin and the northern West Bank are bone dry, except for neat rows of silver-green olive trees. According to Muslim tradition, these ancient trees are blessed by God. But in today's fractured Palestinian economy, they've assumed a more practical role.
The olive tree is the main feeder of the family. In conditions of siege and a bad economy, it's our only source of income, and it's a given source of income.
Palestinian olive farmer Mahmoud Issa takes a break from plowing to hammer a busted tractor part back into place. He says the trees surrounding us have been passed down from father to son for centuries, a cycle unbroken until today. Israeli forces recently walled off much of Issa's land in order to protect a nearby Jewish settlement. Now he needs a special permit to cross the barbed wire checkpoint and work his fields. He says it was like losing a part of himself.
This is the catastrophe. There is a great deal of humiliation in crossing. You can't cross with dignity.
These conditions have fueled violence in the region for decades. But instead of casting stones at Israeli tanks, Issa and a newly formed cooperative of 800 farmers are resisting through economic means. Behind the steel doors of this warehouse on the outskirts of Jenin, workers bottle extra virgin olive oil destined for markets in the U.S. and Europe. It's both certified organic and fair trade. That means consumers pay higher prices so that farmers like Issa are guaranteed a fair wage, more than twice what they'd make selling on the local market. But it's not just the money that's driving them. The program's director, Nasser Abu Farha, says each bottle sold abroad carries an important message, made in Palestine.
It's an exercise of recognition, especially in the Western world, where the word Palestine has been deleted from the atlases. We put Palestine on the shelf. That's a recognition of Palestinians as a nation, a recognition of Palestine as a country, as a place.
Abu Farha says that recognition is the first step toward any lasting peace with Israel. It also opens the door for the next step, economic cooperation. An American organic soap company is creating a model for doing just that. Olive oil is the main ingredient for Dr. Bronner's famous liquid soap. So in a symbolic act of peace, the company has begun mixing oil from both sides of the conflict. It's only a fraction of the region's total harvest, but Abu Farha says it's a start.
The mixing is not going to address all the problems that exist on the ground in Palestine and Israel, but the more these exchanges become equitable and respect of each other's identity, each other's entitlement to land, to fair return from our farms. When we can bond with each other on these principles, the future is very bright.
It gives a hope that maybe in the future there will be some cooperation.
Olive farmer Michael Strauss grows the Israeli portion of Dr. Bronner's olive oil supply. His hillside grove is only 10 miles from Abu Farha's warehouse. But unlike the West Bank, the economy here is humming. Trucks passing on the highway below us carry a steady stream of Israeli goods to the port of Haifa for export. economically, Israel is doing just fine. But Strauss says the Israelis still need the Palestinians.
There's an English saying, if we don't work together, we'll hang together. So that is exactly what it is. If we don't find a way to cooperate in a broader sense, I don't know how the existence in the Middle East is going to continue in the right way, yes.
Strauss says his olive grove will likely be returned someday to the Palestinian family who planted it more than 200 years ago, a time, he says, when Jews and Muslims coexisted peacefully. Strauss, who's 68 years old, says he may not see peace in his lifetime, but his olive trees, which live as long as 1,000 years, will. In northern Israel, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Sam took his video camera along while he was reporting that story for us. He took some still pictures, too. They're on our website at marketplace.org. I was sitting outside eating dinner tonight when this woman walked by wearing a full hijab covered in black from top to bottom, including her face. She had hot pink stiletto heels on her feet, though. It's tempting, when things like that happen, to assume some kind of disconnect between Islam and the present day. Commentator Samir Shahada says that's not the case at all.
Americans commonly assume that Islam, and the Middle East for that matter, is anti-modern, or at the very least in conflict with modernity. The reality is more complicated. Islam is no more in conflict with modern life than other religions, and Muslims of all stripes find themselves thoroughly enmeshed within the modern structures of states, markets, and technology. Today, teenagers from Morocco to Syria and beyond are addicted to Facebook. They're enthralled by video clips of scantily clad women gyrating to modern, commercialized Arab pop music. Fatwas, or religious opinions, are now delivered to Muslims over the internet on request. And Muslim scholars and preachers have hit the airwaves where they connect with millions across the globe. Modern Muslim preachers have taken to the air as well. Take Amr Khalid, the most famous televangelist in the Middle East. Khalid is a middle-aged Egyptian accountant by profession. He's thin and nerdy-looking. He dresses in a business suit rather than a traditional robe. Khalid sits on an empire that includes a wildly popular TV show, CDs, tapes, and one of the most visited Arabic language websites. Khalid preaches a kind of modernist, Protestant ethic version of Islam. He encourages worldly success as a means of achieving spiritual peace. In front of a live studio audience, television viewers listen to his accounts of early Islamic history. Khalid's devotees glean from his interpretations how to live their lives today. The lessons are simple: hard work, perseverance, good manners, and self-reliance. Khalid markets this version of Islam like a self-help manual to middle and upper-class Muslims searching for both salvation and success. Because, like us, Muslims in the Middle East and beyond are coping with the stresses and strains of modern life. And Islam, like other religions, provides comfort as well as answers to many of life's questions.
Samir Shahada is an assistant professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, a healthcare theme park in the Middle East.
Like you would go to Disney, for example, although it's not the right comparison, but you would go into Disney and you'll feel that all your steps in Disney is also well thought through.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was a bumpy ride for investors worldwide today. In the U.S., Wall Street opened sharply lower, but shares bounced back on hopes that we could soon see the end of all those write-downs at financial firms. The Dow Industrials rose a quarter of 1%, 35 points, to close at 12,145. The Nasdaq hiked 0.8%, 19 points, to end at 2263. The S&P 500 climbed 0.7%, 9 points, to finish at 1317. Goldman Sachs gained 1.5% today after Standard & Poor's predicted financial companies are about done writing down assets. Merrill Lynch was up nearly 3%. Chrysler announced it'll shut down all of its plants for 2 weeks in July. It's privately owned, of course, but Ford traded down more than 5% today. General Motors dropped nearly 3%. Markets overseas were awash in red. London's FTSE, France's CAC 40, and Germany's DAX all lost around 1.5%. Here in Dubai, the DFM General Index lost a little more than 1%. Bonds fell. Yields on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com. You can learn more about the Middle East region with the interactive map on our website. Look for the Middle East at Work section and click on the map link. It's all at marketplace.org.
A desert oasis be without a golf course? Doha Golf Club opened its fairways in 1997. In addition to 1,300 palm trees and 10,000 tree trees, 65 cacti were imported from the Arizona desert to make this desert look more deserty. 8 strategically placed lakes offer water hazards on this playground for long hitters. If that's not enough to get your game on, Tiger Woods is developing an 18-hole championship course in Dubai land. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace and the Middle East at Work from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is a city down the road from here we've mentioned a couple of times this week, I think. Abu Dhabi is using its oil money to change the Middle East in its own ways. Less ostentatious than Dubai, more refined, the folks down there will tell you. It's getting a local branch of the Louvre Museum. Frank Gehry's designing a new Guggenheim there. And it's launching what it hopes will become the Gulf's newspaper of record. Abu Dhabi's cherry-picking reporters and editors from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. We can't tell you what the paper is going to be called because they wouldn't tell us before it launches sometime next month. But a couple of days ago, we drove the hour or so down the coast to talk to Deputy Editor Hassan Fatah, formerly of the New York Times, and I asked him why Abu Dhabi is starting a paper now.
We're all part of the same project, ultimately, and that is to basically put this place on the map, but just as important to basically say, you know, this is the new Arab world. Certainly there's an oil boom going on and there's a lot of money swimming around here. But there's good things being done with that money.
Let me ask you the business model question, right? The rest of the world newspapers are moving from the print page to the computer. You guys are actually putting out a print product there. You're starting this new thing.
Well, okay, first of all, we will acknowledge that, you know, the web is going to become an important part, and we will launch with a website and that sort of thing. But the fact is that demographics are on our side. This is the fastest growing country in the world. Internet penetration is not that strong here. So by definition, the old model of the newspaper still exists and is still thriving. In fact, there's a reason why newspapers like the Times of London are now jumping over themselves to publish here. And it's because, you know, you've got a lot of expatriates, a lot of educated Arabs, a lot of people who want to read an English language newspaper all landing here. The least of my problems is commercial. This newspaper will be here in 10 years.
Is your mandate actually to be profitable? I mean, it's not like the government of Abu Dhabi needs money.
I am funded by essentially a venture capital fund that's given me money to bring talent, some of, you know, the top talents from around the world, but ultimately expects me to break even.
Is there a conscious effort in this part of the UAE to contrast with Dubai and its image as a center of commerce and business?
I mean, I think there is a conscious effort to do it differently. The way they put it here is they've learned from the lessons of Dubai. They're not interested in necessarily in revenues and selling and that sort of thing in the same way. They don't really need it. They have all the oil here. What they do want is to basically stand for something. The economic development problems, the rise of extremism, all these different problems that the greater Arab world is suffering from, you know, there is a way out of it, and they want to show the way out.
You're owned basically by the government of Abu Dhabi. Do you worry that people might say, oh, man, they're owned by the government, I better cooperate?
Well, that can be a plus and a minus.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, in some ways, that could help you in getting people to say, take you seriously. You know, look, you know, the idea of us being government-owned locally is, in fact, not a bad thing. And in fact, gives us a certain street cred that an independent paper would not have, ironically enough. But it is also just a reflection of the different way the government works here and the sense of the government seeing itself as a driver of change.
Hassan Fatah is the deputy editor of a newspaper we don't know the name of yet. It's going to start in about a month. Hassan, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's easy when you're here in the middle of it to talk about Dubai like it's a country all by itself. It's not, of course. It's just one city in the United Arab Emirates. But in a way, Dubai is a lot of cities. New developments here have been divided up into tax-free, regulation-free zones, each with their own neighborhoody kind of names. Broadcasters are in Media City. Internet companies are clustered in Internet City. There's going to be a sports city soon. And the model extends to all things medical, too. Healthcare City is shelling out $500 million to build Harvard Medical School Dubai. Marketplace's Sean Cole grew up hanging around Harvard Square, so we figured he was the guy for this one.
To be clear, Harvard isn't going to own any hospitals or teach undergrads in Dubai. It's running postgrad and research programs at Dubai Healthcare City. And the guy in charge has a really long title.
My name is Robert Thurer. I'm Chief Academic Officer of the Harvard Medical School Dubai Center Institute for Postgraduate Education and Research.
Dr. Thurer spends about half his time in Dubai. I caught him at his Boston office before I went over there. He says the development of healthcare is a key part of Dubai's plan to become the de facto capital of the Middle East.
You really can't have a world-class international city unless people feel comfortable traveling and relocating and everything, and healthcare is important.
But the economic benefit could be more direct than that, too. Dubai Healthcare City is hoping to become a hub of medical tourism, that is, people flying to different countries for specialized care. Not to mention the fact that the government of the UAE covers healthcare for all of its citizens. So if an Emirati flies to, say, London for heart surgery,
in addition to paying for that surgery, I mean, they're paying for the person and his family to fly to London. They'll put up family in a hotel room. So it turns out that most of these expenditures are not directly related to healthcare.
Whereas if when you are there, whereas, they won't have to do that.
Exactly. The major teaching hospital is in the excavation stage. It will be done in about 3 years. So you'll see a big hole in the ground that gets bigger every day.
Okay, I'm now in Dubai, standing at the construction site, and sure enough, it is a large hole.
You'll be able to have a Starbucks.
Just like in Boston. It's actually eerie how much Dubai feels like a North American city and how many American businesses are here.
There is a Citibank here. There is Rafael Hotel here.
Maher Musalam showed me a room-sized tabletop model of Healthcare City and the area around it.
There is a Grand Simplex, there is a Grand Hyatt, and there is a big, huge park for children. They call it the Child City.
Musalam was part of the Dubai Healthcare City sales team. He says a lot of really famous organizations have bought into the project.
Mayo Clinic, we have AstraZeneca, we have American Academy of Plastic Surgery. We have big, big, big names in Dubai Healthcare City.
And big names spell credibility. Dubai is all about being number one. Even Abu Nader, a local investor who'll be running a convenience store, beauty salon, and travel agency in Healthcare City, is banking on big returns.
Of course. Yeah. Maybe as per His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, the vice president and the ruler of Dubai.
Right, right.
He is always looking to be number one.
And are you also looking to be number one?
Of course. I want to be number one here in Healthcare City.
That's why he's part of us.
Yes.
It's really Sheikh Mohammed that conceived of the whole theme parky structure of Dubai, Healthcare City included.
I wouldn't say it's a theme park. I want to say it's a destination.
Muhaditha Al-Hashimi is the CEO of Healthcare City.
Like you would go to Disney, for example, although it's not the right comparison. But you would go into Disney and you'll feel that all your steps in Disney is also well thought through. That's what we want to do in Dubai Healthcare City.
And why ask for Harvard's help?
I don't think we've found any other academic institution with the reputation that Harvard has to match the reputation that Dubai Healthcare City wants.
It's quite a name.
Yes, absolutely.
And both Al-Hashimi and Dr. Thurer said that Harvard would likely benefit from the relationship too. But Dr. Thurer says there's a much larger goal as well.
To improve the standing of the United States internationally.
Well, that's very grand.
No, I think it's incumbent on all of us. I mean, ultimately, international relations is human relations. And if we have, you know, lots of ways that we can help other people in a positive thing, it's incumbent on us to do that.
For my part, I intend to spend some more time in Dubai teaching Emiratis how to say Harvard. No, I don't. In Dubai, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
We've got some cool aerial shots of Dubai online. Check them out at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org, and by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
Well, TGIT, everybody. Tonight is the start of the weekend in much of the Middle East. We haven't really mentioned them so far, but the beaches here are pretty nice. This one, Jumeirah Beach Park, costs 5 dirhams to get in. It's about $1.35 U.S. Pretty good considering the rising cost of beach club memberships here. At the Ritz-Carlton, it's $13,000 a year. So last Friday, the cheap beach was mobbed. There was volleyball going on. Ice cream vendors. IT worker Helen Matthias kept an eye on her two young kids as they played in the sand.
I just wanted the children to have a nice time. In, like, all the time they're in the house or in school, so they really don't get the open air.
Alvin Manulid came to Dubai from the Philippines. He makes around $380 a month as a housekeeper here. He gets free food and housing, too. He says back home he'd have to have a college degree to do this well.
But here, even your ordinary people, you didn't finish even college, you can make that money. In Philippines, it's very difficult to make that money.
Not everybody's here to relax, though. Ranjit Hemachandra rents out plastic beach chairs to the wealthier clientele.
Too much hard work.
He gets Wednesdays off, and you can bet he doesn't spend it at the beach moving those chairs around. That is Dubai, and that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 35 points, a quarter of 1% after a crazy day. The Dubai General Index lost 65 points, a little more than 1%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, investing from the Middle East to the Far East.
I think it makes perfect sense for the Chinese to give that kind of priority to the Middle East. And it fits very well within the agenda of the Middle East as well, which is rapid expansion, very focused on cost and price.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
وسائل الإعلام الأمريكية.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.